Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we are going to take a look at the career of actor and director Olivia Wilde, whose name actually is not really Olivia Wilde, but she went with Wilde because she's a big fan of Oscar Wilde.
And that actually is worth talking about a bit more because she comes from a really distinguished family, really
going
way back.
That's putting it mildly.
The family name essentially is Coburn, and she actually is a dual American and Irish citizen. And as you read about her family, her ties to the UK, to United Kingdom, are as strong as they are to the United States. Indeed, one of her ancestors, I don't hold this against her, but one of her ancestors was part of the invading British army in the War of 1812, and he actually led the troops that burned down the Capitol and the White House. Ironically, you talk about not holding it against her, but ironically, she grew up in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And her family, and I know of the family, actually, you know, because her family on both sides involves journalists, her parents, both print and broadcast journalists, but also her uncle Alex, whom I was familiar with for many years when he was writing at the Village Voice. So I knew the byline, as they say. I knew the family byline that way. And it's one reason why when she came on the scene as a young actor, she's still young, but when she really was young, the name, you know, I was trying to figure out like who she is, like the newcomer, like where is she from? And as I read about her, I thought, oh, I know who she is, but just simply knowing the lineage there. And in some ways, it's fascinating because I hesitate to use the term royalty, though, of course, her ancestors were fighting for the king. but in some ways, even though we officially don't have aristocrats in this country, her family has a very distinguished background of what I'll call a quasi-aristocracy. And if you look at her prep school background in D.C. and elsewhere and all, not that it's entirely silver spoon in the mouth, but she comes from, I sort of think of it in sort of like Gwyneth Paltrow terms, like this is a classy person. Like she's not like right out of the gutter. She comes, or at least she comes from a very nice gutter, right? She's from a really good background. And it's one reason why I had trouble pegging her as an actor, frankly, at first, because, you know, she clearly is quite beautiful, well-spoken, well-bred, as they say, all those nice things, but in a kind of waspy way, right? But then she's had such a diversity of roles, and she's been so prolific. I really have had trouble pegging her, and that's meant actually as a compliment here. Like some actors, you immediately know in terms of character type, personality, there's something that hits you, right? That's what she does. But if you look at her filmography, she's all over the map with what she's done. So there was a period of years where I knew who she was, and I couldn't quite like reduce it to one or two sentences. This is what she's like as an actor. And ultimately, that's a compliment.
Yeah, see, that's interesting because I didn't know any of that about her. I looked it up. I knew her from House. I mean, that was my first exposure to her, very down-to-earth role, so that's just how I assumed that she was. But there's even more fun facts to know and tell besides growing up and going to school in Georgetown, just like basically down the street from us. Her paternal grandmother, Jean Ross, was the inspiration for Christopher Isherwood's character, Sally Bowles.
Yeah, how's that?
Which was, you know, portrayed in I Am a Camera with Julie Harris, right. Of course, Cabaret with Liza Minnelli. Christopher Hitchens used to babysit her.
I know, and I knew Hitchens a little bit because he was very much a Washington, sometimes Baltimore kind of guy.
And her friends, were friends with Mick Jagger.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah, but what's funny about Christopher Hitchens, he's now, sad to say, no longer with us, but very much left of center journalist and rabble rouser. And his books, and I highly recommend his books because they're so polemical. They're guaranteed to get you riled up. My favorite is his book about Mother Teresa. He actually detests Mother Teresa.
How is that possible?
And the title of his book is The Missionary Position. And in that book, well, what he asserts there, and it's very controversial, is that the order of nuns she belonged to was very secretive about its financing and may well have had ties to American government interests and so on. And I heard him talk about that once in Baltimore, and I thought, well, he's being cheeky with it, but he had a point, actually, is that if you actually look at the finances, there's not much to look at because they really were tight to the vest with all that. But the reason I smile the more is Hitchens was funny because he was just such a hard drinker and smoker and partygoer and loudmouth and all that, and I liked him for all that, right? He was good company, as they say, good bad company. And in any event, I remember once, like, he was so angry. He was speaking at the Pratt Library in Baltimore, and you can't smoke indoors, of course, and he was, as a Brit, he was outraged, like, well, I should be able to smoke wherever I want.
Right.
So I remember we were talking with him out on the front sidewalk because they wouldn't allow him in the library. And I thought, but he's the guest speaker today. Well, but he he's smoking. But he was determined to finish his cigarette before he went inside to give his talk. So the reason I give that long-winded anecdote is the fact that when I was just now reading up a bit more on Olivia Wilde, I actually did just learn this, that he had been her babysitter. On the one hand, I'm not surprised because I knew that he was close with the Coburns. In fact, he often would talk about them and be with them. So I wasn't surprised. I was surprised they would allow him to be the babysitter. I would not trust I would not trust my children with him, believe me. I'm sure they had a great time and all that. But again, you know, taking the jokes out of this and back to the core biography, it's another indication of how, if there's such a thing as like left of center aristocracy, this family would qualify. And I really, in terms of the tightness of it, it helps explain also, to jump the gun a bit on this, the fact that besides her acting career, she's very active politically. You mentioned the Just Cause, and she's been there. And then also when you mention some of her films, whether as an actor or director, you can sense that, you know, there's a real mind there. And I'm trying to think how best to phrase that. But she's not just taking roles. Sometimes she's taken roles, I think, just to take roles. You look at the filmography includes some duds, frankly. But, yeah, it's a paycheck, right? But some of the other stuff you can tell is more close to the heart.
Well, the last anecdote I was going to mention, just throw out there, is that she is a fifth cousin of Rose Leslie through Scottish nobility. And Rose Leslie is an actress I just discovered by accident this past week when I had the flu. I binged watch a series called The Good Fight, in which Rose Leslie plays this major role. So it's kind of like the way I feel about Olivia Wilde. Like all of a sudden, someone is everywhere. And you're like, who is that? And you start, you know, looking into what they're all about. Of course, I think Olivia Wilde's, you know, presence is much more obvious than Rose Leslie. I just thought it was interesting that I discovered her fifth cousin by accident.
But see, this is, you know, reinforcing the fact that she's been hard to peg, because with that quasi-aristocratic appearance and that sort of what I call sort of a mid-Atlantic accent sometimes, you don't quite know. Like you know, when she was first making movies, yeah, I did a little bit of research and learned a little bit, but by the same token, I couldn't quite peg her. And as I said earlier, you know, it's essentially a compliment, but sometimes in the early roles, I was trying to get a fix on, oh, yeah, I've seen her before. She did, you know, this TV series or a few movies. But, like, where is she from? Who is she? That kind of thing, which actually sort of keeps you watching in some ways. But I oftentimes felt like, you know, she could just as readily, this is a hypothetical, she could just as readily have established herself in the British film industry, when you think about it, right?
Yes.
With that lineage and with what I always call mid-Atlantic accent, you know, which on this side is, well, you went to Georgetown Prep or something, you know, that sort of prep school background. But boy, you could slide right into the British films, couldn't you?
She certainly could. Yeah, she definitely could. Of course, she's been the face of Revlon, so...
Doesn't hurt. I know.
No, that doesn't hurt.
I knew that as well, actually. And this is a confession. I don't mind making it. When she was first coming on the scene, I mean, I knew of her in television more than actually watching her in the TV roles, but I knew who she was from that. But when she started becoming the face of Revlon, not that I thought less of her. In fact, it's a nice face, right? So I didn't think less of her. But what I did think was just, well, how seriously should I take her? And I know that's like a stereotypical reaction, but simply when you have someone who's like a fashion model or the face of Revlon, you kind of wonder, well, she'll get Hollywood roles, but will they be what I call decorative roles?
Now, see, that's interesting, because when I think of like the face of Lancome or Dior or whatever, you know, they always pick somebody who's almost transcends beauty, but is famous, like Catherine Deneuve or Isabella Rossellini. So I thought her being the face of Revlon actually meant she was just unquestionably a fabulous beauty.
But there's a crucial distinction here, namely that some of the other people you mentioned who really are, you know, iconic actors, for the most part, these are people who had already established an image and then for that reason became the face of. At the point where she was being the face of, not that she was unknown, but you see what I'm getting at? She wasn't as famous, as iconic as they would have been. Catherine Deneuve, sure, at any age, at any point, you know, she's a great fashion image. With Olivia Wilde at first, it was still a career in the making. And that's the point where she could have gone hypothetically into the British film industry. She could have, frankly, just been a fashion model and you know, famous photograph, if you will, or just played what I call the decorative roles. To her immense credit, she's really got the acting chops, and she, you know, was proving it at that point even. I was the one who kind of stereotypically was thinking, oh, well, just be a beautiful face. And I thought, no, there's real acting talent and ultimately real directing talent there.
One of the reasons I wanted us to discuss her on the show is because of Booksmart.
Oh, thank you for mentioning that.
Because I saw that film and I knew that she had directed it. And I just really appreciated a movie about smart women. So maybe we can talk about, you know, the fact you sort of hear the crackle of her intellect in lots of little places and stuff like that.
For folks who haven't seen Booksmart, just to give the essence of the storyline, it's essentially about two girls who are best friends in high school and what it means to be a smart kid. And when you're a smart kid like these girls are, you deny yourself a lot of fun. Other people are going to parties, you know, weekends, you know, at the football field, whatever you do. And they're like, no, I got to study for an exam Monday, that kind of a thing. Because they want to get into good college, which we're all for here, right? So we want to get into good college. Well, but then, you know, what if you overhear conversations like, you know, like in the restroom at the Mirror or just walking down the hallway of what all the other kids are up to, all the fun they're having. And then, and this is salt in the wound, and then you realize, wait a minute, some of these kids are just going to parties and fooling around and just getting by. They're going to really good colleges.
Right.
Geez, what happened to me? Like, I didn't go to that party.
And, hey, wait a minute.
It's the hey, wait a minute moment. And I like that for the reasons you cited, that it's a film that's not afraid to be about smart girls, but also to point out some of the ambiguities and nuances and just frustrating aspects of high school life in terms of, well, what should you be doing at that point? And how sometimes kids who, you know, are just fooling around, goofing off and all, end up getting like really good colleges and really good jobs and all. And you might feel like, gee, I wish I weren't so smart, or I wish I just fooled around more in school. And the nice thing about the film is not just that as a premise, but the fact that it has a real-time quality. And by that I mean a lot of the scenes, really, frankly, are not pushing plot points particularly. They're just kind of like, you know, the ambiance of it, the hanging out quality, if you will. And that works really well. On the one hand, you know, she directs this film really well, and it's well packaged and well scripted and acted and all those good things. On the other hand, and this isn't her fault whatsoever, but on the other hand, it pretty much remained on what I call the art house circuit. It did okay. It got really good reviews. People liked it who saw it, but not enough people saw it. And so what one hopes for here is what in the old days we used to call ancillary. In other words, if you didn't see it during its brief first run, that you catch up with it. And through streaming services, of course, you can stream, you know, The Creation of the World at this point. It's all there for the viewing. And so Booksmart is definitely something to check out if you haven't seen it. And you know, with that growing respect I've had for Olivia Wilde as an actor and filmmaker, it's really Booksmart, I think. Mm-hmm. Push come to shove more than anything else, where when I saw that film, I thought, you know what? And she doesn't show off in it. It's not a
yes.
It's not a show-offy, glitzy film whatsoever. You could say it's functional direction, but functional direction can be good in the sense that you want to keep the camera just on those two girls as they're talking back and forth. And also with their developing intellects, I mean, as they get smarter and wonder if that's such a good thing necessarily, but also in terms of sexuality and so on, as to, you know, the world they're exploring as they grow up. And that kind of deliberate pace and kind of non-showy quality in terms of technically making the film, I think Olivia Wilde, because sometimes if you have a chance to direct your first feature film, and she'd been acting for a long time before she directed this, there's that tendency to want to make your Citizen Kane out of the gate, you
right.
know? And I'm so glad that she held back or just somehow knew, no, you don't have to like show off your editing and camera work and all that. Just show the story. Just let the story tell itself.
I saw it in the theater with a lot of women of, you know, middle-aged women who cackled at a lot of the lines. And one of the things they get absolutely right is what it's like to have friends in high school and how volatile things can be. And there's a scene where the two leads end up having a shouting match at this party. And all of their friends are standing around videotaping it and putting it on YouTube, which strikes you as this is so exactly what would happen. But also, this is how you would have to live your life where you really don't have any private moments. It was a really telling little thing she stuck in there about social media. And it was funny, too.
It was funny and also sad because, you know, those melodramatic confrontations, especially between best friends,
yes.
that's eternal. That's always been the case with the volatility of high school friendships. Your best friend, you know, one month becomes your enemy the next or something. But the fact with social media that all this is streaming live, if you will, there's this documentation of it. And then the whole world, and particularly in that kind of high school setting, when all the kids know what happened at that party and they all can see it. And then, in effect, it's a rating system, like what got the most hits, you know, my fight or your fight, that way. And in terms of the sensitivity and the insecurity of all of us at that age, imagine having that bouncing around the viral universe. That really is the sad part of it, is the fact that you can't just say, oh, well, that was last weekend and it's behind me. Well, if it's been documented like that, it's not behind you. It's still there for others to enjoy, and in a kind of sadistic way. You know, have a look at this. Isn't this funny?
Yes.
Well, it wasn't so funny for the girls involved.
Well, the other part of that is that idea of your whole life is on display, especially if you do anything like get in a fight with somebody. But also, you know, the worst thing is that, you know, you make up with your friend, but, you know, there's all those horrible things you said, you know, permanently documented.
Well, this will be a cynical observation, so I'll make it. This is a case where we've been talking about in terms of, well, you've had what should be a private or quasi-private moment, like an argument at a loud party, and now everyone knows it's totally public, and how people share that and how the focus is on you eternally. That's all true. By the same token, we've got to say the extent to which people want to have every moment documented in their lives. So it cuts both ways.
That's true. That's true. I just thought it was a very smart, witty movie. Now, one thing I think has sort of raised the profile for that movie and director Olivia Wilde is if you go to a Regal Theater, they have this series going on before, after you watch all the previews, right before they're actually going to show you the movie, they show you a little short made by students and it rotates. But the person introducing it is Olivia Wilde. So she says, hi, I'm Olivia Wilde, director of Booksmart, and I'm so happy to, you know, promote young filmmakers' work. And then you actually see the short. So, you know, people are being reminded every time they go to Regal Movies that her name is Olivia Wilde, she made Booksmart. And then these really nice movie intros come on.
She's Regal in all sorts of ways.
She is. But good.
But also, it's a very pointed reminder that in addition to being a talented actor and director, she's got a producer hat. And when you look at her biography, whether these short films that you so rightly mentioned, but additionally, there have been at least a handful of documentary films, some of them feature length, that she's been at least a co-producer of. And not that these are under the radar, but she's not flashy about it. Like the Regal Theater thing, there she is, you know, on screen introducing, and that's great. But some of these other projects, it's just like, again, when I mentioned earlier, the things that are close to the heart for her politically and so on, that she just does these projects. And I'm just, I don't know her finances, but I'm assuming some of these things are not exactly done for a paycheck or a big one. You know, it seems more like from the heart or to help somebody out that way. And honestly, she's at the point in her career now where she could do big bubblegum movies and make many millions of dollars. But doing some of these other projects surely takes at least months at a time away from doing that kind of box office film.
Well, I think it was a really smart choice to do Booksmart because it does pass the Bechdel test, where if you have women talking, they're, you know, they're not just the love interest of a male character. And if they're having a conversation, it's not about men. So it has a different twist on, you know, the usual way things are presented, which I appreciated.
And also in that respect, of course, the love interest in Booksmart might be one woman for another woman.
Right.
Right. And that,
right.
And it's handled in a way. Now, of course, that's increasingly, I don't want to say the norm, but increasingly accepted, quote unquote, in terms of screenwriting, in terms of films, to have that sort of same-sex relationship. What I liked about it in Booksmart, it doesn't have any sort of controversial or newsworthy aspect necessarily, which is actually a healthy thing, right, that it's more normalized. But it's in that respect that it plays out as something, well, yeah, these girls are exploring various things in high school. In other words, there's a naturalness, there's a norm. Not that they're always easy with it within the film or that some of the other high school kids would be, but that increasingly you can have that as a plot strand and it's not suddenly like an absolute world crisis. You know what I'm getting at?
Right,
it's just more like the more normative crisis you would have in high school, like, you know, who is it I love kind of questions. And now, of course, that it's not just, you know, is there a boy I want, but is there a girl I want?
Mm-hmm.
And then as the girls talk back and forth in terms of, because at a certain level, once that's accepted, at least by the principals, there's then the strategizing. As
right.
In, well, how do you get your heartthrob? You know, what's the best strategy? Who's your wingman or wingwoman on that? And as you do that, you realize the extent to which, well, yeah, romantic relationships are complicated, whatever's one's gender preference there. But then what's funny here is the fact that they are truly exploring new ground by way of, you know, to act on the impulse to get the loved one and so on. And that's one of the things that does have a kind of topical edge to it. Because, again, we can look to earlier romantic comedies, but there haven't been that many prior models as to how would this play out in screenwriting terms. So here you have it where just as the girls are exploring this, frankly, filmmakers are, you know, it's increasingly common, but by the same token, it's not absolutely the norm now. So it still has a little bit of an edge to it, a little bit of frisson that way.
Nice use of frisson in a sentence.
Merci.
Booksmart ends with the two girls going off to have pancakes, which is notable because Olivia Wilde once won a pancake eating contest in Australia.
Now, that's a trivia note.
That is a fun fact to know and tell right there.
Is she doing ads for IHOP? I mean, is
well, I think she just stuck it in her movie and then moved on. I like that little anecdote.
I always like inside references, right? I always enjoy those.
Yes. Also, even though she, obviously comes from a really good family, apparently when she moved out to Los Angeles, she lived in a school bus.
What should we make of that? Yeah, but it was a school bus, not a...
Right.
So come on now. Well-educated.
Not a mini, right?
Well-educated.
Yes.
I'll have to research that a little further.
So I just wanted to talk a little bit about some of her other roles that people might have seen her in. People may have seen her on The OC and on House. House is, of course, where I saw her. I thought she was fantastic. But I absolutely love that show. Tron Legacy, Cowboys and Aliens, People Like Us, Her, Rush, Drinking Buddies, The Longest Week, Love the Coopers, Meadowland, a small role in Richard Jewell, and A Vigilante, which I would like to just mention briefly.
I want to, in that long list, and again, a reminder just how prolific and how diverse she's been in film. Some good, some bad, some box office, some small. It's kind of an interesting mix overall. I'm not making big claims for Cowboys and Aliens, but when that came out, it totally bombed. It got bad reviews and bombed at the box office and all that. And again, I mean, I can think of much better films, but I was amused by it because, talk about genre switching and so on, to take, the alien invasion film and to take a Western, the cowboy film and to mash them up into each other. I thought it was kind of intriguing, kind of interesting. And that's why that was at that point in her career when she was in it, right? You don't know quite what to make of the film itself, right? Already it's mixing all these elements. And I thought, well, how did she get in this? Which camp is she from? And it ties into what I've been saying here about, trying to peg her that way. But yeah, there have been some of the smaller films she's been in, like A Vigilante, which, tie very directly into her social activism. So why don't you talk about that a bit?
Well, we could think immediately of, Charles Bronson. There have been plenty of movies.
She's better looking.
She is definitely better looking than Charles Bronson. But, the whole Vigilante.
He was never the face of Revlon.
No, never the face of Revlon.
The sales would have plummeted.
Unless it was the before picture. But the movie's fascinating because it's, she's the vigilante. She's the one who is the avenging angel. And there is a scene very, very early on in the movie that establishes her credibility in that she, goes to confront this man who's been abusing his wife. And he thinks he's about to get the jump on her. He thinks he's actually going to take her by surprise and overpower her. And she, just chops him right in the neck and he goes down. And there's not even a moment of hesitation or, let's be ladylike about it. It's just, and it is awesome. And you never see women get to do that.
Well, you actually do in the sense that, I think...
maybe like Uma Thurman and Kill Bill or Scarlett Johansson and Lucy.
So your general point's correct there, but there actually is a kind of distinguished lineage there in terms of the female vigilante. And when you mention Charles Bronson, Death Wish, films from the early 70s, you think of Clint Eastwood, and we'll double back on him when we talk about Richard Jewell, but you think of Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, you're right, it's a very macho thing, the guy who's going to take the law into his own hands and so on. You're absolutely right about that. But what's curious is if you go back to the early 70s, I'm a big fan of blaxploitation films. And when you think of, some of the Pam Grier roles and so on, where, the Foxy Brown kind of things, where she's going to take matters into her own hands, and she's really quite gifted with karate chops, among other things. But also like Abel Ferrara and decades since in films like Ms. 45 and so on. I mean, that because what it does, a film like that, what it does, it takes the assumption that it's an ultra-macho genre or subgenre, and it says, let's flip it. Let's have the woman who's been, somehow hurt or offended and needs to take matters in her own hands. And that gives it a real grindhouse charge, and of course, certainly with Quentin Tarantino, he knows all that material. So yeah, let's get Uma Thurman, let's have Kill Bill that way. And, and these are great looking vigilantes, right? They always have form-fitting outfits and, they're really, all turned out there. And they really, make you laugh in some ways because they go right against all the stereotypes, all the genre conventions, and they're a lot of fun that way. Back to your point.
She's more like a Bond assassin, though, than just an animal.
But it's not that surprising then that there would be that character. But what makes a vigilante interesting is the fact that Some of the other genre films I've mentioned, you know, push come to shove, they're just frankly exploitative, right? I mean, you know, they might be making some good points about gender equity, blah, 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 but you're not thinking about that particularly as you're watching it, perhaps. But in The Vigilante, it's just simply that because this woman is focusing on families that have suffered domestic abuse, and then through flashbacks, you get her own backstory and so on. And there's that more serious underpinning, if you will. You know what I mean? It's not just hitting buttons of, you know, the quote-unquote entertainment value of watching her off these people. There's a real serious underpinning for what she's doing.
Yeah. She also plays, like you said, it's hard to peg her, a nightmare date in Her. And you had something you wanted to say about her in Richard Jewell.
Yeah, it's an interesting case because the film itself was one of Clint Eastwood's rare box office bombs. Critically and commercially sank very quickly. And I have very mixed feelings about the film because I think it's internally confused. I mean, just to remind one, in 1996, the Atlanta Olympic Games, Richard Jewell, the title character, is a security guard, private security guard, and there's an explosion in Centennial Park, and, you know, he becomes a suspect. In the court of public opinion, he's deemed guilty, even though the authorities haven't charged him formally. And he falls into the stereotype there of a man who's not the brightest bulb, frankly, who's, you know, homely looking, overweight, still lives with his mother, ding, ding, ding. You know, all these things that make you think, what a loser, right? And it's sort of a reminder of, well, if a bomb goes off like that and the security guard responds and becomes a hero and turns out maybe to be the perpetrator, what's going on? Well, it's the volunteer fireman syndrome. I don't mean to malign volunteer firemen, but it's that demographic of if you're a pyromaniac, where do you go for a job? You join the fire department and then you set the fire and then you go to fight it and you're the hero for fighting, right? And there are documented cases like that, a really tiny percentage, but there are. So he's instantly pegged by the media in that respect. And actually, the actor playing Richard Jewell and everything about the film is actually quite well done in that respect.
Very well done.
What really, though, hurts the film is her character. She plays an Atlantic Journal Constitution reporter who's investigating, and the performance is fine. It's the character that's faulty because the whole gist of Richard Jewell thematically is that we should not unfairly stereotype people and make those assumptions, you know, that people aren't that stereotype necessarily, and certainly Richard Jewell was not. He was a good guy in so many ways. And so what's it do to her character? Well, you know, paradoxically, cruelly, hypocritically, she's a female newspaper reporter. In order to get information, what does she do? She sleeps with a source, an FBI agent, and that's how she gets it because that's how women get information, right? You know, and so it kicks out the one set of stereotypes and crucially substitutes all those stereotypes about, you know, a female in a professional role. And the real-life reporter it's based on is no longer with us. She's not here to defend herself, but all of her colleagues at the paper and others says, look, she was hard-charging. She was this, she was that, but she wasn't sleeping with her sources, you know, and they were demanding an apology. So that's where the film is internally conflicted.
Well, the controversy, I think, really hurt the film. But, you know, and as much as I like Olivia Wilde, I didn't even recognize her in the movie for the longest time. And then I realized, I was like, oh, my God. You know, because you just had never seen her play that kind of a role.
But you know
before.
What? That's underscoring everything we've said about how, isn't it? Not that she's quite a chameleon, but she's played this range of characters. I actually, as I was watching it, kept thinking about how wrong the character was, and that bothered me. But even though that bothered me, I wasn't thinking about her as the actor. I just thought, well, it's a good performance, right? It's a really misconceived role, but it's a good performance in it.
So speaking of film set in Atlanta, the next project up for Olivia Wilde is directing a biopic about Carrie Strug called Perfect. I don't know if you remember the Atlanta Games when the Team USA's first gold medal was won by the women in gymnastics. And part of the reason they won is because Carrie Strug went ahead and did that final vault, landing on her broken leg. So she's going to be the person behind the camera bringing that to life. I think she will bring an interesting take on that.
But how many movies can she make about the Olympics, you know? I guess she's trying to make amends for Richard Jewell at this point.
Well, she's also going to be directing and starring in a movie called Don't Worry, Darling, a thriller about a woman who may be losing her mind. The most apt way to describe it is as a psychological thriller for the Time's Up era. That will be interesting.
Well, when you mention it, it reminds me that when you think about A Vigilante or about the project you mentioned, she's taking what is potentially potboiler material.
Yes, good point.
She's visiting or revisiting these genres, and because she's got those smarts, she's book smart, she's got those smarts going in her favor, when she takes material, vigilante type material like that or what have you, it's going to be a better than average film within that entry. Because sometimes you hear that storyline, you might just want to shrug it off like, oh my God, like what you used to call a B movie, right?
Right.
But she's got the filmmaking smarts to think, well, wait a minute, this can be a worthy vehicle for things she wants to say about a specific female character or women in general.
I hope it turns out to be something like an I, Tonya, where you get the backstory and you didn't know and you thought this, and maybe you should think that.
Yeah, that's a really nice comparison to make, because that's where we all had our assumptions or our notions about what was going on in that case. But, you know, it's a chance to revisit that material and maybe to rethink some of it.
Well, that's the end of today's program. Make sure you look for us on the web at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.